thought. A related issue in Enlightenment sentiment was both moral and social, and that was the debilitating or coarsening effect of the slave system on young white men and women. They grew up expecting to command and to be obeyed. They were schooled from childhood in cruelty. Their finer sensibilities were calloused by regular exposure to legally sanctioned suffering. Adolescent and adult white males expected to command the favors of female slaves. White youth were, to use a popular modern expression, victims of the system. Moreover, since a significant part of their inheritance and fortune was invested in slave property, they were helpless to change or abolish the system. In the North, New Englander Jedediah Morse noted that in 1789 that slavery is the bane of industry. It renders labor among the whites not only unfashionable but disreputable. A third type of argument against slavery was humanitarian, which was not actually moral reasoning but was an appeal to human pity. What in logic you learn is a fallacy, the argumentum ad misericordiam, the appeal to misery. It emphasized the cruelties inflicted on the slaves in the form of whippings and other humiliation. We see here an engraving of the time of a slave being whipped by the overseer, and the other slaves were forced to stand around and watch that punishment. One of the major vehicles for the development of public sentiment against slavery on humanitarian grounds was the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe, best-selling fiction books in American history. Then we have Alexander MacLeod going back 50 years before that to 1802. We've mentioned him before and we'll talk more about him today. He insisted that Christians had a moral responsibility to empathize with the sufferings of the slaves as well as with those who suffered from other causes. While very sympathetic to the slaves' suffering, Covenanters recognized that cruelty was an essential element of the slave system because it was necessary to control the slaves. Slavery requires cruelty. But the sin, and I'm quoting MacLeod, J.R.W. Sloan, the sin consists in the relation, ownership versus servitude, and not in the cruel behavior primarily. Okay? Because slavery was a sin in itself, cruelty was an auxiliary sin which increased the guilt of the slave owner. A fourth kind of argument was economic rather than moral or theological. First, it was sometimes thought that slave labor was less expensive than the hire of free labor and provided an unfair economic advantage to slave owners. This was apparent if a small farmer, for example, owned no slaves and so was compelled to hire laborers or to rely on the help of his wife and children in the fields, or to reduce the scope of his farming operations, while his slave-owning neighbors flourished and extended their farms by using cost-free slave labor. When a factory owner was able to buy or rent slave labor at a lower cost than hiring free workers for the same job, he depressed the market for free laborers. Much like the controversy in our own day about the extent to which illegal aliens take jobs from other Americans. Statistically, however, evidence showed that the economy of the slave states was less productive than that of the non-slave North. In 1789, Jedediah Morse had pointed out, from repeated and accurate calculations, it has been found that the expense of maintaining a slave, if we include the purchase money, is much greater than that of maintaining a free man. And the labor of the free man, influenced by the powerful motive of gain, is at least twice as profitable to the employer as that of the slave. Mid-century statistics showed how far the free states exceeded the slave states economically. In 1850, the 16 free states had a total valuation of real and personal property of $4.1 billion, including, of course, no unfree persons. The 15 slave states, almost the same size, you see, as the non-slave states, had a $2.9 billion total valuation, and that included 3.2 million slaves. The value of the hay crop alone of the free states in that year, 1850, had a retail value more than four times the value of all the cotton produced in the United States. Parenthetically, in 1856, the real and personal estate valuation of New York City alone was $511 million, which was far more than the entire state of Virginia, which was considered a wealthy southern state. It was perfectly clear from these facts that slavery did not produce prosperity or foster production. Some advocates for slavery turned this argument about efficiency on its ear. True enough, they said, owning slaves, which entailed the responsibility to provide clothing, food, shelter, medical care, cost more than the slave earned in production. Slave owning was economically counterproductive. So, they said, slave owners should be reckoned among benefactors of mankind, providing philanthropically for a helpless and incapable race, generously sacrificing their own well-being for the good of the Africans and the protection of white society. Now, we hardly need to say that this argument is laughable, but, incredibly, it had its followers. In the fifth place, the North had a powerful and legitimate political argument against the slave system in the federal ratio, which we've mentioned before, by which three-fifths of the slaves were counted in the population for purposes of representation in Congress and the Electoral College. The slaves could not vote, of course, and they were regarded by state law in the South as chattels. And selectively counting 60% of them as though they were people significantly skewed political power in favor of slave states. And Northerners asked, well, if they can count 60% of their slaves, can we count 60% of our cattle and horses? And, that in the first place, the answer was no. But in the second place, they laughed at it. That anybody would suggest that. But you see, these extra congressmen represented not the slaves, not the poor whites, but the slave owners. The slave states used their power to the fullest in national politics by blocking attempts to limit the expansion of slaveholding, by insisting on the admission of new states that permitted slavery, and by dominating the presidency. 10 of the first 16 presidents were slave owners, and they dominated the Supreme Court. Since Congress had fixed no minimum population for the formation of a new state, a number of new states, slave states, were thinly populated. In the 1850s, for instance, six of the slave states had a total free population of 190,000 people fewer than Pennsylvania. But of course, being six states, they had 12 senators versus Pennsylvania's two. This political imbalance gave rise to the term the slave power, and periodically created crises in government, which in turn required further compromises, especially those of 1820 and 1850. In addition to these ethical, social, humanitarian, economic, and political arguments was a sixth line of reasoning, biblical. This kind of argument was unacceptable to many people in the 19th century, as it would be today. This kind of argument, the defenders of slavery offered literalistic, literalistic Bible arguments to support their pro-slavery views, But biblical theological reasoning was foundational to the anti-slavery thinking of many Americans, including the Covenanters. The earliest systematic exposition of the Covenanter position was Alexander McLeod's Negro Slavery Unjustifiable, published in 1802. And that, as you may recall, came just on the heels of his being ordained and installed minister at Coldenham, New York. Coldenham and New York City, 70 miles apart, which was quite a hike in those days, horseback or walking. You couldn't just hop the train, but he served both congregations. Anyway, the text for McLeod's discourse is Exodus 21:16. He that stealeth a man shall be put to death. He that stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. This was a political law for the Hebrew nation, but because it's grounded in the moral law, it is obligatory still on every subject of moral argument. It's based on the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. If a person who steals such possessions as money is guilty of sin, a person who steals someone's father, brother, wife, or child cannot be innocent. Moreover, as a person who knowingly buys stolen property is held complicit in the theft, so one who buys, holds, or sells a stolen person also shares in the guilt. If you buy a car from somebody and you know that it's stolen, you become part of the guilt. You acquire guilt of yourself as being complicit to that theft of the car. Perpetual slavery, he says, is inconsistent with the natural rights of man. And the way the term natural rights of man was used by Christians at the time was different from the way the political class, the Enlightenment class, defined it. Natural law for believers meant God-given law. The rights of man, in other words, are not inherent, but derived from God. A person's life and faculties are the gifts of God, and no one has a right to take them unless he has forfeited them by crime. The opposite principle would be absurd, he says. Everyone would have a right to sell and enslave everyone else, in which case law becomes raw force and justice becomes cunning, a Hobbesian nightmare of all against all. Slavery, moreover, contradicts the natural general tenor of sacred scriptures, including Jesus' command to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. When apologists of slavery asserted the inferiority of blacks, they violated the reality of creation expressed in Acts 17:26. God has made of one blood all the nations of the earth. Slavery, says McLeod, violates four of the Ten Commandments. The fifth commandment requires that children obey their parents in the Lord. But under slavery, the children are taught to obey the master or the overseer rather than their parents, which violates the God-given order of the family. The sixth commandment not only prohibits taking the life of another, but by implication, as you may remember from studying the Shorter Catechism, requires people to preserve and protect the lives of others. Under slavery, however, the lives of the slaves are at the absolute whim of the master. The lives of slaves were held to be of no value beyond their retail or market price. The commandment, which prohibits stealing, is violated because slavery robs the slave of the fruit of his labor, except for whatever food and clothing is graciously granted by the master. finally, he says, the 10th commandment, which forbids covetousness, is violated because the slave owner is avaricious. He employs servants without wages, enriches himself from the coerced labor of others, and sells. McLeod also said that slavery contradicts the gospel of free grace. That is, the slaves are in the same position, they're in sin, and in the same need, the need for a savior, as the owners are. There's no use pretending that the owner is better than the slave morally. They are brothers of equal standing before the Lord. McLeod also refuted a number of common arguments in favor of slavery. I'm not going to read these right now because we're going to see how McLeod refuted each of these. The first claim that he refutes is the alleged inferiority of blacks, of Africans. And they said it is just for the more intelligent to rule the less intelligent. They're miserable in Africa anyway. They're no worse off being enslaved here than they were in Africa. But, says McLeod, the apparent inferiority of blacks is greatly exaggerated, and it results from circumstances. They've been willfully and forcefully held in illiteracy and ignorance. And if there are laws against teaching the slaves to read and write, then you can't turn around and blame them for being unable to read and write. Even if they were less intelligent, which he emphatically denies, it does not follow that they should be enslaved. They would still have the same fundamental God-given rights to liberty and self-determination. The second and closely related argument was that Negroes are a different race or species from whites. They clearly cannot be descended from the same pair, Adam and Eve. As early as 1774, an Englishman named Edward Long had developed a race where it was situated between Europeans and orangutans. And as late as 1906, a Mbuti man named Otabenga, who was a pygmy, as we often refer to them. Technically speaking, these days we're supposed to refer to them as forest peoples rather than pygmy. But if you look up pygmy on the internet, you find the information about them. Anyway, Otabenga was placed in a cage in the Bronx Zoo and was labeled the missing link between orangutans and the white race. In fact, an orangutan was put in the same cage with him. In the mid-19th century, this argument was expanded into what was called scientific racism. As the most readily available response, McLeod pointed first to Acts 17:26. God has made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of all the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. McLeod then points out that there are individual differences within every species. Climate, diet, and other variables, particularly over a long span of time, explain the differences observed among people. Again, he turns to the device of reversing the argument. If the argument were true, it would prove too much, because any nation could claim superiority of rank over any other, and once again, violence would be the only basis for law. One of the most popular biblical arguments in favor of slavery was that the Negroes were cursed because of the curse on Adam's family in Genesis 9:25. Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. Blacks, they said, are descendants of Ham, and so are forever enslaved. McLeod makes short work of this argument. First, the curse was directed at Canaan, the son of Ham. Even if Africans were descended from Ham, they almost certainly were not descended from Canaan, because Genesis 10:19 identifies their territory as Syria-Palestine. That is, they were among the nations expelled from the Promised Land when the Israelites conquered it. There's nothing in the biblical account to indicate that all of Canaan's descendants were condemned to perpetual and eternal slavery. Besides, he says, the curse was a prediction and not a rule of duty. God has given many people over to slavery in the course of history, but the tyrants and murderers who ruled over them, for example, Egypt, Babylon, Rome, were held accountable by God. Finally, if the curse of Ham argument were to hold water, every slave owner would somehow need to prove that he's descended from Shem or Japheth in order to avoid being enslaved himself. And so he says, McLeod says, this argument doesn't hold water either. The fourth objection to ending American slavery was that God permitted the ancient Israelites to hold slaves. True enough, answers McLeod, but not relevant to modern nations and the modern style of slavery, which was absolute and permanent. Like other ancient peoples, under the prevailing customs of war, the Hebrews could use prisoners captured during war as slaves. Israelites themselves could be sold into servitude for theft or insolvency. If a thief could not be sold into servitude so long as he had enough property to repay the theft. If an Israelite were impoverished and indebted, he could be forced into servitude, but not with rigor, as Leviticus 25 puts it. In either case, the maximum term of service was 6 years, and when a debtor was set free, his master was required to give him some livestock to go into business again. Foreigners could be acquired as slaves, but the same laws were applied to them which applied to the Hebrews. Leviticus 24, one manner of law as well for the stranger as for one of your own country. Additionally, he pointed out, the Israelites were not authorized to send ships to distant lands to steal or buy, chain and torture people who had done them no harm. They had no precedent for that, no divine approval, and no instances in their history. The fifth objection offered by the advocates of slavery was that in the New Testament, Christ and the apostles do not condemn slavery as it existed under Greek and Roman law. That, says McLeod, is untrue as well as irrelevant. Untrue because Paul, in 1 Timothy 1:10, condemns man-stealers, which is often translated slave traders. In Corinthians 7:21, he advises slaves to procure their freedom if they could, but if not, to continue patiently. In Colossians 4:1, he directs masters to treat their servants justly, mercifully, and with fair wages. In any case, it would not be reasonable to base a system of ethics on all of the realities of Roman society that are not expressly condemned in Scripture. Feeding Christians to the lions, for instance, as you see on the left side of the page, is not specifically prohibited, but that didn't make it ethically permissible, you see. A sixth argument in favor of slavery said, in effect, yes, the practice is wrong, but here they are. We found them as slaves and we can't do anything about it. McLeod paraphrases this argument, saying, these advocates say, if you do wrong long enough, it becomes right. If the first stealer and the first buyer sinned in enslaving their victims, the one who continues the crime continues the guilt. The best reparation is to set the slaves free at once. The passage of time does not change the moral law. Christians, says McLeod, have an obligation to empathize with the sufferings of the slaves. This is not a situation to be contemplated coolly or merely theoretically. The slaves are our brothers, human beings who are to be commended to God, the God of mercy and comfort. Christians must do everything in their power to alleviate the sorrows of the slaves. Ministers have a duty to preach and teach on the subject, speaking the truth in apt circumstances. Legislators and statesmen must exercise their responsibility to work quickly to correct this evil practice. Throughout the anti-slavery era, Reformed Presbyterians consistently emphasized the biblical theological slavery is a sin not only of individuals, but of the whole nation. An unsigned argument, or essay, in the Reformed Presbyterian magazine in 1838 argues that because holding people in slavery is sinful, slavery is protected by the federal constitution, so therefore the whole nation is guilty. That is, all the people who belong to the nation so constituted are guilty. We share in the guilt of the country as a whole. The slave states are guilty of slavery, and because the free states have joined with them in the federal constitution, they too are guilty. True, the Union did not create slavery, but it gave it national sanction. If it is wrong for an individual to hold slaves, it is wrong for a state to permit him to do so. But if it is wrong for a state, it is equally wrong for a number of states to recognize it in their national constitution or confederacy. Continuing to admit slave states makes the sin a national one. Slavery in the District of Columbia can't be blamed on a state. It's an act of the national government, act of Congress. Now, as we'll see at some point during the Civil War, before the Civil War, the slave trade in the District of Columbia was abolished, but slavery itself continued until the Emancipation Proclamation. When opponents of slavery argued the sinfulness of slavery, many of its proponents turned not to defend against this charge, but to fall back on its constitutionality, believing that this answered every attack. But of course, this is neither a moral nor rational defense. A legal defense, perhaps, but not moral or rational. As we've seen in previous weeks, Reformed theologians had long been opposed to slavery. Samuel Rutherford in 17th century Scotland wrote, "A man being created according to God's image, he is res sacra, a sacred thing, and can no more by nature's law be sold and bought than a religious and sacred thing dedicated to God." And I'm indebted to Joyce Lynn for providing me this quotation just this week. All this talk about personal and national sin might leave us today just bewildered. What was the basis for all this? The basis, the root, is that Covenanters had a distinctive theory of the state. That developed during the 16th and 17th centuries, but its classical exposition is in Samuel Rutherford's book, Lex Rex. You see it below his name there. The law is king, in 1644, arguing that even the king must be subject to the law. Two points are especially relevant to our topic. First, Reformed Presbyterians believe that every government must acknowledge the authority and law of Jesus Christ in its foundation, its constitution, and must seek to make its laws conform to the will of God. Second, that church and state must each pursue its God-given function free of control by the other. The state does not control the church, and the church does not control the state. And by the way, in our time, people who are opposed to this viewpoint throw around the word theocracy. Theocracy is a meaningless term anyway. It means government by God. If you mean government by ministers or clergymen, it would be hierocracy. And that's not what we're about. we're talking about church and state as free of control from each other. They are co-equal, if you will, in their responsibility before God. These are the reasons underlying RP political activism. They are calling on the United States to honor Christ by obeying what the scripture, reason, ethics, morality, and compassion teach about slavery. The long history issue was not slavery, but freedom. Their ancestors had been denied freedom in Scotland. The more recent ancestors had fought for freedom in America. And in the plan of God, freedom was the norm for human life. Anything which prevented human beings from freedom was therefore sin and to be opposed. The principle which they expressed, that man cannot hold ownership in man, was held to be true regardless of skin tone, intellectual ability, or any other consideration. RPs relied heavily on the account of creation in Genesis and on Paul's statement in Acts 17:26, God has made of one blood all the nations of the earth. The necessary corollary was all people are brothers, all created by the same God and given the same fundamental rights and responsibilities. This leaves no room for enslaving one race, no room for enslaving any race in perpetuity, no justification for either shame or arrogance about one's race or national origin, not even if you're Irish. You'll remember that we talked about the RP congregation of Coldenham, New York, and its role in eliminating slavery from among the RPs. Turning once again to Coldenham, we see one of the early stages of racial integration in the denomination. Remember that Alexander MacLeod was the one who would not accept the call to Coldenham until and unless they got rid of the slave owners, or the slave owners in the church got rid of their slaves. And so this congregation had a long history of being kind of the cutting edge of the RP anti-slavery movement. Coldenham is a little village, if you will, not far from Newburgh, up the river, up the Hudson River from New York City. By 1817, the pastor was James Renick Wilson, who was pastor from 1817 to 30, and then he went to Albany for 3 years and came back, was called back to Coldenham from 1833 to 40. By the way, he's the great-great-grandfather of Dave Wilson in our congregation. 2 years after his installation, the first black member was admitted, a man named Jephtha Williams. From then until his death 32 years later, Williams brought over 60 new black members into the church, including 13 families. So he was a very efficient evangelist. Part of the reason he left the Goodwill Presbyterian Church to join the Covenanters was his discovery that blacks could be buried in the Coldenham churchyard, unlike the Goodwill Church. And I like the irony in that the Goodwill Church would not allow blacks in the cemetery, and the RPs at Coldenham did. In 1839, Pastor Wilson discovered that not all of the members of the congregation were free of racism. The session adopted a requirement that all of the blacks sit in the balcony during services. Wilson gave them a verbal tongue lashing, followed by a written statement of reasons of protest. He enumerates 13 reasons why their action was sinful. And I'm happy to report that the session backed down and blacks and whites continued to sit together in the congregation and at communion, as they did in other RP churches. New York City, for example, he cites as an RP congregation where blacks and whites sat freely wherever they chose in the church and at communion. We turn now to another major advocate against slavery in the generation following J.R. Wilson, and to a man named after him, James Renick Wilson Sloan, or J.R.W., as he was usually known. After an early distinguished career in Ohio and Indiana, including a short trick as president of Geneva College, he was called in 1856 to be pastor of the Third Reformed Presbyterian Church in New York City. In New York City, he played a role on the national stage, both as a leading preacher and a fearless abolitionist. His sermons were published or summarized in the New York Times and the Tribune. As a speaker, he often shared a platform with such famous leaders as William Lloyd Garrison, Wendell Phillips, and Henry Ward Beecher. Only a year after coming to New York, Sloan was invited to give the address at the 1857 annual meeting of the New York Anti-Slavery Society. Under the title Slavery in Church and State, he dealt chiefly with the influence of slavery in the nation and in many of the churches. He spoke of the contempt that he had heard among slave owners in Kentucky, where he had taught school for a couple of years, their contempt for ministers who attempt to justify slavery on the basis of the Bible. So not only did our Pease find that argument invalid, the Southern slave owners laughed at it and laughed at the ministers who advanced that argument. 3 years later, on May 29, 1860, Sloan addressed the second annual meeting of the Church Anti-Slavery Society in Tremont Temple in Boston, the meeting we referenced at the beginning of our time today. Taking as his title The Church and Slavery, Sloan focused on the churches and ministers who defend slavery and rebutted in some detail their arguments. One of the things he said was, "If there is one reason for which, more than any other, I hate the slave system, it is the foul disgrace and dishonor which it has brought upon our holy religion. Slavery is a blotch on the face of Christianity, the Christian faith." Sloan cut to the heart of the controversy when he said, "The sad plight of the country is not political, not legal, not Northern radicals versus Southern fire eaters, but that we cherish a system at war with all the laws of natural justice. Therefore, the remedy does not lie in political parties or in the election of a Republican president. Rather, the only remedy is to get rid of the mischief." Christ's first sermon, he said, was an abolition discourse from an incendiary publication of Isaiah, an anti-slavery book of the Old Testament. If I can get my pages apart here. Yes. Slaves were admitted to membership in the church in the apostolic period, but he said there's no proof that slaveholders were. Now, you'll think first of Philemon and Onesimus, but there was a lot of debate, pro and con, on both sides in the antebellum period about whether one was really a slave of the other or whether it was more like a friend or a long-term employee or something like that. So assuming that was not a slave situation, there's no proof that slaveholders were allowed membership in the church. After the war began, he preached a sermon which was printed in full in the New York Times, page 1, on December 1, 1861. His text was from Exodus 5:1. "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go." Freeing the slaves is necessary in order to secure a moral basis for the war and a claim upon the sympathy of foreign nations. Revolutions never go back. And if these states are ever to be restored, it will be as free and not as slaveholding states. Very prophetic in that. The building in which Sloan preached still stands in New York, although it's no longer an RP church. By 1920, most of the congregation had moved away from the center of Manhattan. It was located at 238 West 23rd Street, and it still is located there. By 1920, most of the congregation had moved away from the center of Manhattan, so the church relocated out in the country to the Bronx. The building they sold to a Hebrew congregation, and it's a synagogue since 1920. But you can see it's a substantial building, very attractive inside as well as outside. Well, next week we'll look at Covenanters and the Underground Railroad. We're just about on time. I have hurried today. I hope I haven't talked too fast, but I was trying to get to the end. So, thank you very much. See you next week, Lord willing.